What is up, you imperfect men? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We're back with our second wildcard episode of the month.
Double dipping.
Holler to your five Wednesday months. This week we're going to do something a little different, I guess.
Well, it's always a little different, I suppose, right? Way to give back for all the theater folk who've endured all of our sports episodes.
Exactly. And so we're going to, I don't know if you guys have heard, there's this musical called Hamilton that's coming up right now. I think it's going to be a big deal.
It could be really popular.
So I think, you know, I know tickets are still available. You can probably just walk up and grab them before people really hear about it. But this week, we are going to look at the musical Hamilton and its Shakespearean parallels.
Yes, I think that should be rewarding, promising, and fun.
And if not, it's just going to be better than nothing, as we always say about our wildcard episodes.
So, ready or not, here we go.
So, I guess I'll give my background on my history with this musical.
Sounds
so
good.
So, Hamilton was developed at the Public Theater in New York, where I was working at the time that this started, and it hasn't really come up that much on this podcast, but both Dan and I are big Revolutionary War fans.
It is pretty amazing that that hasn't come up yet.
Right? That, like, we're both very into it. Holler to our British listeners, scoreboard. So this is something that we've both, everyone that I've worked with, I make it very clear that I'm very into the Revolutionary War. And people started saying, like, years and years ago, like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. Like, you're going to love it. And I really hate when people tell me I'm going to like things.
Sure.
That's just a thing that really gets in my craw. So
that's
what
I said to you when we first met in college. I'm like, you're really going to like me.
And I still waiting for the jury to come back in on that one. So I had been hearing for years and years, oh my God, you're going to love it. Oh my God, you're going to love it. It's so great. It's so great. It's so great. And I'm like, yeah, we'll see how much I like it. Oh, and shit. So I went in to see it with, like, arms crossed at when it was downtown at the Public, like, ready to hate it.
Yep.
And it's really good.
It's really good.
It's really good. But what I really liked about it and what surprised me is it's a Shakespearean history play. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
In more interesting ways than just a regular, like, well, I guess that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah,
the other parallels that are beyond just it being a direct history play.
Right. I come at this from an almost completely different place. I have no exposure to Hamilton quite by choice because I kept saying, I'm going to wait until I can see this musical. I completely buy into the fact that it's the greatest thing ever. And I want to see it fresh and not know anything about it. But then this podcast came up and it was like, well, I guess I'm not going to see it this week. So for the last 5 days, if you've been anywhere near me, I've been like humming and singing and like, have you guys heard of Hamilton? And I've been that guy.
You didn't just go to TKTS and see if you could grab a ticket?
I have the app, but it's not showing up for some reason.
Oh, that's weird. That must be a glitch.
So yeah.
And then, of course, on top of both of those things, as of this recording, there are no less than 4 Hamilton podcasts rated in the top 200 performing arts section on iTunes.
Sort of selling out and coming after you, Hamilton.
Come on, give us those clicks. So if we tricked you into listening to our No Holds Barred podcast because you were looking for a 5th Hamilton podcast, we got you.
This is No Hams Barred, the Lin-Manuel Miranda podcast. Lin-Manuel Miranda would be listening to. Lin, listen to us. And then retweet us and get us internet famous again.
Okay, so let's dig in on
Without
this.
Without further ado.
Right. I think just to take it from a purely mathematical standpoint, the timelines.
Yep.
The events of Hamilton take place from approximately 1775 to 18, I don't know when Hamilton died, 1810, around then.
We're going to get tweets up the wazoo about this answer. I think I'm going to go with 18. I'll go over on 1810.
Okay, well, regardless, it's about 225 years ago.
Yeah.
Is what we're looking at. The distance between Shakespeare and, for example, Henry V is about 175 years.
Right.
So the distance is is definitely comparable.
Yep.
And I think that's interesting because that's something that kind of gets lost when you're, at least maybe not now, but when I was in like high school,
sure.
I assumed they were happening at about the same time.
Oh, interesting.
You know, that Shakespeare was writing about something in more recent history.
Right.
You know, but not that it was generations and generations ago.
More like Charles III, the play that was just
exactly.
On,
yeah, yeah,
on
yeah.
Broadway.
Which is literally a Shakespearean history play that was just on Broadway.
And then set
I mean, not
in the
literally.
Future.
Shakespeare didn't write it, but in more a, more classically
didn't?
In the style of a Shakespearean history.
Right.
But I think it's interesting that, you know, 5 years ago, if you asked an average American high schooler,
yep,
what Alexander Hamilton did,
right,
their only frame of reference, no, I don't know. I mean, for me, if you asked me in high school, my only frame of reference would be that milk commercial from the late 90s.
Aaron Burr.
That's right. The only, like, that. And he's on the $10
bill. $10 bill is a thing. I mean people might not even have known that.
Of course, I know what else he did as a big fan of the Federalist Party, but
well,
others may not have. And now, if you ask an average high schooler what Hamilton did, they can give you everything.
He was an orphan, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly,
dinka, binka,
et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's interesting in that you see, you know, there. I've read, especially recently, as Richard III's remains have been discovered and more, you know, they had to check to see if he actually had a hump.
Right, because that was more of a propaganda piece.
Exactly, because Tudors. Shakespeare was the one that put out how disfigured and disgusting he was, but it's like, well,
right,
he wasn't. He didn't really, but it's just been absorbed into culture.
Sure. That's an interesting thing, too. Speaking of culture, it's fun, I think, for Americans. I think we can lose some sight of when they're doing a British history play. There are just certain things culturally that are in the British vernacular that they just know, that you grow up knowing in the same way that we might not know who Hamilton is, but when someone's like George Washington, you're like, oh, yeah. Oh, cherry tree.
Right, exactly.
I know that guy. Wouldn't you? Like, there's something you can go back to. In that way, this resonates culturally for us, which is, it's a cool experience to go, oh, neat, I know these characters, so I can actually get a different take on the story because I'm not going, who is this?
Right, and wait, right, who is Margaret and who is Lady Grey? How does that all tie together? You're like, oh, yeah, Madison. Yeah, I know him.
Oh, and here comes Jefferson. We haven't seen him. We introduced Jefferson in Act 2, but we already like, oh, yeah, Thomas Jefferson, cool.
Right, exactly. You don't, there doesn't need to be a family tree in the program so you can follow along with what this is.
You drop a Monticello reference and everyone's like, oh, as opposed to like, I'm lost.
Right, and that's actually a good segue into one of my other things that I think is, well, I guess there are two different ways to take this, but not only that it's American history. I'm going to say our history probably, but I mean American history.
Sure. The royal hour.
But when you're talking about familiarity, one of the other things that I loved about watching this is there are moments in this play that in this musical that are going to be the equivalent in 400 years when high school kids are reading the Arden Lin-Manuel Miranda that are going to be footnoted as a reference to things that were happening now. My favorite example being in the song Aaron Burr, Sir. All of these songs are available on iTunes and Spotify and YouTube. And so if you haven't listened to it yet, you should probably go listen to it.
And if you're on iTunes, you might as well click over to No Holds Barred Podcast
and just
subscribe,
rate, review. And we'll give you a complimentary link to the YouTube soundtrack. But in the song Aaron Burr, Sir, there's a part where the rest of Hamilton's crew comes out and they drop a, what time is it?
Showtime!
So what I love about that, obviously, that's what, for those of you who have been to New York City, that's the sound that you hear right before your commute is ruined as a group of high school kids come in and breakdance and like do backflips on moving trains. It's like, you know, they're busking basically with backflips and dancing and very loud music.
As someone who takes the Q train frequently, between DeKalb and Canal is like a long above ground stretch, and I get showtimed on that pass all the time.
It's a long, yeah, absolutely.
Because they can really do a nice routine there.
So that's going to be something when you get, you know, in school children in the year 2416 are going to be like, what is this joke?
Right.
What time is it showtime?
Right.
And they'll have to, an actor will have to act it out with their hands like, I am dancing now. This is a reference to a dance that people did at the time. It's like, what's the thing they do in
the Morris?
Yeah, it's right. It's the Morris dance.
Yeah.
That we're like, what the hell is a Morris dance? And I was like, oh, Showtime is the same thing.
The reality is the actor isn't going to have to do it with his hands because it's going to get cut in 400 years.
Exactly. Like,
it's on the cutting room floor. It's
exactly.
Gone.
So I love there are those things all over the place that really clarify and, you know, draw that line between. Right. Exactly. The Morris dance. Yeah. The stuff that's going to get cut.
Yeah. Speaking of that reference to New York City and the subway, something that I think Shakespeare does in all of his plays that is really interesting in Hamilton is you never forget that you're in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
That like in Shakespeare's plays, you're always in London, no matter where he sets it, no matter where the action takes you. He's got half of his mouth is speaking about what's happening in London right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the same sort of thing where it's like there are moments in here where you're like, oh, yep, this is definitely written by someone in New York.
Right.
When he's talking about, you know, in Hamilton Heights, and you're like, oh, yeah, I can go see that after the play.
Mm-hmm.
Or before, which is kind of cool.
The whole thing about New York being the greatest city in the world, that whole,
you know, that's
pandering.
There's that thing. Mm-hmm. Something, you talked about Aaron Burr, sir.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the song, not calling you sir, mm-hmm. sir. But I do think mm-hmm. that something that is what I really love is that's some nice stichomythia.
Mm-hmm.
In that song where there's a repeated it's a break in the sort of rhythm that he calls on frequently throughout the play. Whenever Aaron Burr sir comes on, we break back to that rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you see in several of the plays that Shakespeare, Benedict and Beatrice do it a lot. When they end up in scenes together, their rhythms change.
Mm-hmm.
And that they pick up each other's sort of cadence, and it breaks out of iambic pentameter and just goes into like this shared heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is really, it's a kind of a nerdy, poetic similarity between Hamilton and Shakespeare is the use of rhythm and stichomythia.
Right. And it's something that in this format, you don't need to be sitting there with the script in front of you being like, oh, see this here? This, when they do this bit with the Aaron Burr, sir, like that's a reference because it just, we can perceive that because we have, our ears are tuned to hip-hop stylings.
Absolutely.
In a way that we have to assume the Elizabethan audiences could pick that up without having to, you know.
Yeah, they weren't going, oh, stichomythia. They were just going like, oh, now we're in this sort of jive, this sort of jam.
Right.
So yeah, speaking about rhythms and tempos, I think there's a really, really cool job that Lin-Manuel Miranda does here in Hamilton of establishing sharp contrasting shifts in mood.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when King George, we first see George,
mm-hmm.
we get the Farmer Refuted comes in first, and there's a super big change in tone there, which to me feels like the equivalent of going verse to prose or prose to verse.
Mm-hmm.
And then when George comes in, the rhythm suddenly, we move out of hip-hop R&B, and it goes more towards, it's like a swingy, it sounds like the Beatles. It's British Invasion pop.
Hmm.
And it's much more, it's not silly, but it's light.
Mm-hmm. It's more classic musical comedy.
Absolutely. And the rhymes, it's all simple rhymes. He rhymes at the end of the line. There's no rhymes internally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complete, like your ear has now been trained to keep up with Hamilton and the revolutionaries. And then here comes the British king. And he's like, it's sort of like Herod in JCS.
Mm-hmm. Jesus like, Christ oh, Superstar.
Jesus Christ Superstar. And that to me resonates in terms of propaganda of like, oh, of course, Americans are all like, oh, George was crazy George and he was insane and we hated him. So here he comes out like dawdling with this like borderline comedic song talking about murdering your family.
Mm-hmm.
Just to remind you that he loves you, which is
right.
A fun antithesis of that presentation of two contrasting ideas in the same line. Here you have someone singing sweetly and like la-di-da-di-da-da about I'm going to kill your family and your friends. Right. Which
it is very Herod. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. I think it's kind of fun. It's sort of he does that a lot where there's a lot of inside baseball.
Musical theater references.
Musical theater references.
Yeah.
And then also just to speak to that rhyming, the idea of George's rhymes versus Hamilton and Burr's rhymes is similar to looking at the verse of like Silvius from Two Gents versus the verse of King Lear. Which is so much more dense and complicated and intricate.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to Silvius, who is like a young lover, and it's just what light is light if Silvia be not seen, what day is day if Silvia be not by. Like, this is real easy stuff.
Right.
Comparatively.
Right.
So I love that. I think that's really interesting. He does that a couple other times, too, in terms of Also in Farmer Refuted, I really like the fact that there's the line that you never forget that you're in a play either. There's a real dramatic reference where he says, don't modulate the key and then not debate with me.
Right.
It just reminds me of those lines in Shakespeare, which are like, if this were played on a stage now, mm-hmm. it'd be condemned as improbable fiction, mm-hmm. which is like, oh, you're right. This is still a piece of theater, and right. let's never forget that.
Right. Piggybacking on what you were saying, you know, about the you kind of dipped your toe in this, but, you know, we have the difference between prose and verse in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And I think that in Hamilton, they add a third tier.
Yes.
That you have the spoken word, which, you know, which you haven't heard because you were listening to the soundtrack, but then you have the hip hop. You have the rap, basically, and then rap escalates to singing, I think, in a couple of places. Like in Aaron Burr, sir, there's the part where they're rapping back and forth, and then Burr gives him, he's like, can I give you some free advice? And he sings, talk less, smile more.
Right. Is that auto-tuned?
No.
Smile more sounds auto-tuned to me.
I'm sure it was cleaned up in post. But
nice.
It's... you know, just that is, they're going back and forth, going back and forth. And then let me give you this really important thing that's going to keep coming back. Talk less, smile more. Right. Even the fact that Hamilton's wife, Eliza, is almost always singing.
Yep.
It heightens what she does, that she's the only one that really spends the whole time in song.
Interesting.
And there are bits where Hamilton sings, but they're fewer and far between.
Yep.
But when, you know, even that he's singing in It's Quiet Uptown, he's singing that bit. That's not a rap song. He's mourning the death of his son, spoiler alert, for 250-year-old family drama.
Could you argue that that's because he's associating, is it Uptown or Upstate? What's the name
Uptown.
Of the song?
It's Quiet Uptown.
Is that he's associating that with Eliza and therefore he's singing?
Okay. Absolutely. Cool. There will be many... Bad. That will be our Dan and Kevin do your homework in 2450.
Nice. Speaking of Eliza, I do think there's a really nice corollary in the song That Would Be Enough to the scene in Henry IV, Part One, with Percy and Kate, where he's like going off to war and she's like, just stay with me. Don't go. And I mean, that's almost verbatim what that song is, where she's like, at some point you'll decide to stay. I was like, oh, Hotspur, cool.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a, there's not much more to say about that one, but it was like a straight jump for me.
Mm-hmm.
Something I think is interesting, Kev, in both of these, in the works of Shakespeare, this is a bigger thematic thing, but I really found it very interesting, the idea of fathers and sons.
Okay.
I think that's huge in the canon, and I think it's absolutely monumental in this play.
Mm-hmm.
It just really resonated, especially they set it up really nicely in Hamilton with Meet Me. Ooh, I'm going to get crushed on all the name of these songs. But when Washington calls him son three times.
He's like, I'm not your son. Yeah.
I'm not your son. Don't call me son. Call me son one more time. And he sends him home.
Yeah. Sends him to his room.
Yeah. Right. Well, he's like, go home. And then he gets home. He's like, oh, I'm going to have a son. So there's a nice shifting of going from, you know, you see Hamilton as an orphan son, then to being a father, then to being a grieving father.
Sure.
Which I think you get pieces of that in the canon. I really think Hamilton in a lot of ways reminds me of Orlando in the beginning with that whole, like, I've got nothing but a huge chip on my shoulder and I'm going to conquer the world and nothing can stop me. That's just how I see Orlando.
All right.
Not clever, B.U.S. cineast. She called me out last week for referencing Orlando is clever. I think Hamilton is significantly smarter than Orlando.
Just ask him.
Just ask him.
In the production of Hamilton, you know, and that there's this double casting.
Yeah.
And it's in a very organic way that, you know, after the intermission, the guy that was Eliza's father comes back and he's George Washington. And the guy that was Lafayette comes back and he's Jefferson. And the guy that was Hercules Mulligan comes back and he's Madison. And, you know, that's something obviously that we know that Shakespeare's companies did as well, the double casting.
Yeah.
But it's fun to see, you know, when it's written for double casting, because like with the actor that plays Jefferson and Lafayette, you love him in the first act as Lafayette. And then he comes back as a jerk as Jefferson, but Jefferson obviously was loved France and is always talking about taking care of France. So you see Lafayette bleeding through in Jefferson.
That's really interesting.
And you see, you know, Eliza's father is a father figure. Is a father figure to Hamilton, and then it he becomes Washington.
Oh, cool.
And then so you have that there as well. You have who else?
Speaking of Lafayette, real quick, hopping in on that, I think is a really interesting use of written dialect.
Mm-hmm.
I was from hearing it. I don't know how it goes over in the theater, having just listened to it on Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
But I do get the sense that it's pretty funny.
And oh, yeah.
The Lafayette stuff is really great. And that reminds me of Dr. Caius or Fluellen, where Shakespeare writes the joke for you. And it's like, just
right.
Play the dialect here and you're going to get a laugh.
Speak the speech, I pray you.
Definitely. Oh, perfect segue on that. Were you heading somewhere else before?
Nope. I rarely am.
Speak the speech, I pray you. One of the songs in here, Guns and Ships,
mm-hmm.
is the fastest song in Broadway musical history.
Where do you get that stat?
I pulled this off Dr. Internet, but it comes in at 6.3 words per second.
Holy cow.
Which is 0.1 words faster than Not Getting Married Today from Company.
Yeah, suck on that, Sondheim.
Suck on that, Mr. Steven. I love you, Steven Sondheim. But in terms of speaking the speech, I pray you. And one point in Guns and Ships, they crush out 19 words in 3 seconds.
Holy cow.
So, with that in mind, this is at 6.3 words a second, we could get through Comedy of Errors, which is 14,701 words, in 38 minutes, 53 seconds.
And then everyone would just collapse.
Romeo and Juliet, 2 hours traffic, would actually come in at 1 hour, 4 minutes, and 56 seconds.
Wow.
And Hamlet, uncut, at the rate of speed that Guns and Ships is sung at, would come in at 1 hour, 20 minutes, and 50 seconds.
I would like to see that Hamlet, please.
Speak the speech, I pray you. Hamleton.
Ooh, by William Shakespeare Miranda. There's the funny pun we've been looking for. We can close up shop now. We're done.
So, speaking of Hamleton, one of the things I really enjoy about Hamlet, and I think that the directors have a lot of fun with, is whose eyes you see the play through.
Okay.
Because, you know, I've seen many productions where it's like, oh, this is a story being told by Horatio,
mm-hmm.
or this is Gertrude's story, or mm-hmm. this is Hamlet's actual story, or Hamlet the King. I think that is something that is really interesting in this play, in Hamilton, is challenging perspective.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, how does history look seen through Aaron Burr's eyes?
Sure.
Or seen through Alexander Hamilton's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really neat, you know, in the beginning.
Or through Eliza's eyes, because at the end, she's the one that you're sympathetic for.
Right? And I just think he does a really good job of that. And even there are moments, I believe, again, and tell me if I'm wrong, because I haven't seen it, but it sounds like he backs up when you see him meet Eliza and Angelica,
mm-hmm.
and you see that scene twice, but mm-hmm. once through it. Eliza's eyes and once through Angelica's eyes.
Yep.
That's really cool. Like, that's the same sort of thing of, like, the Banquo taking the intermission Banquo, where it's like, are you seeing it with the ghost or without the ghost?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's something that is a real triumph in this play, is perspective, which is something I always enjoy. Question for you, Kev. Do you know of any spots in the Shakespeare canon where Shakespeare changes the order of history or the order of events?
I feel like that happens fairly regularly in the histories. I know it happens in Richard III, although I don't know if he changes the order, but he definitely plays with, you know, he'll have something happen consecutively in Richard III that actually happened 8 years apart or something.
Right.
There's definitely some liberty being taken with the actual timeline.
And a play about liberty, that's very important.
Ah.
But yeah, that happens here. Especially in Stay Alive, they change the order of things just to kind of make it more dynamic. I know in the greatest musical about the revolutionary period of all time, 1776,
mm-hmm.
they changed things quite a bit. And I remember, I think Peter Stone said, you know, God writes great life, but doesn't necessarily write great drama,
mm-hmm.
which is like, oh, that's fun.
That's a good line.
Good idea, Peter Stone.
Yes, in 1776, they undersold certain legislators' contributions.
I suppose any podcast comparing Shakespeare and Hamilton, we should talk about Take a Break for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically Mackers. Like, they have a whole
They talk
verse.
About Mackers.
They sing Mackers. Yeah. Yeah, what was your response to that in the theater when you heard that the first time?
I gasped. Because, well, because in the song, he's writing a letter comparing himself to Mackers.
Yeah.
And they have a line where he's like, yes. I feel like I'm in the, you know, Burnham Wood watching Dunsinane. I'm sure you'll know who I mean. Please don't make me name the play. But right. then in the next line, he says it.
Right.
Which I think, quite frankly, is a dramaturgical error.
Oh, interesting. I took that as a challenge. I think that as like a, he needs to recognize the fact that it's a curse
yeah.
and let the audience know it and yeah. then go, you know what? Fuck that. I'm Macbeth.
Yeah, great. Worked out great for him.
Well, I mean, clearly the show is not cursed. It's just $700 a ticket right now.
Well, no, the show's not cursed, but Hamilton did get shot in the head. So I don't know that... I don't know that he, you know, ultimately probably could have just pulled up and called him the Scottish King.
Right. in Take a Break, there's a lyric that I'm absolutely obsessed with, which jumped out at me. Like, I ran scrambling to write this down for this pod. But Angelica talks about being caught off guard because there was a comma in the middle of the phrase.
Yes.
When he says, my dearest Angelica.
Comma. Yep.
And as someone who spends more time than I necessarily should looking at punctuation and going, what does this mean? What does this mean?
Mm-hmm.
Commas in the middle of phrases make a huge deal.
Absolutely. And there's a whole verse about it, about comma placement.
Yes.
It's now available for $700 a ticket.
I guess the last thing I was thinking, Kevin, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, is do you think, I think you could draw a straight line through William Shakespeare, is Alexander Hamilton, is Lin-Manuel Miranda.
What?
Yeah.
No.
Grinders, smart men, way ahead of their time, just working their proverbials off.
It's too much
and
club.
Never feeling satisfied. And that's exactly what my perception of Shakespeare was. Clearly, it's what Hamilton is in this play. And my Twitter friend at Lin-Manuel, I think, is the same exact way. So he should probably.
You could draw a line. I don't see how Hamilton fits into this.
What?
I haven't even seen the play. He's not a playwright. He's a legislator.
He wrote 51 Federalist Papers.
Yeah, we don't know how good they were.
You can read them.
Go ahead. Have you read them?
Yes.
Challenge. Shakespeare wrote 38 plays. We've all read
37.
All of them. Who's read all of Hamilton's papers? I could write 51 papers. I have written 51 papers, but nobody talks about them.
They're garbage.
They're garbage.
You know who probably has read all 51?
I did NaNoWriMo. That doesn't mean that I'm a great writer. I just wrote a lot.
Yeah, but you're also not Secretary of the Treasury.
Not yet.
All right. I think Shakespeare is Hamilton, is Lin-Manuel Miranda, is at Dan Bonos.
Is that just, those are the 3 points on this line? Like, I'd like to know who else is on this.
Me!
This evolution. Oh, Jesus. So you.
Yes, were- Jesus, too. That's 5.
So, okay, fine. You know what? Hot take here on ESPN Shakespeare from your boy, Skip Bollier.
Did you just concede? You said fine, so you're now.
No, I'm moving on the record. I am not conceding.
It's me, Jesus, Shakespeare, Hamilton, and Lin-Manuel.
You want to throw the Scottish King in there, too?
So that's our episode.
I guess. Well, there's there's one thing that I am obligated to say that I've said to everyone who I've talked to about this play throughout.
Yes.
There is a major flaw with Hamilton that I have not seen pointed out nearly enough.
Is it the jobless guy?
What?
The guy who has no job they talk about?
No.
Oh.
I don't know what that is. No. It's that we have this hit musical, a history play about the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
Focused on the second most important Federalist in American history.
Yes.
And you're telling me not only there is no spot for, but you're going to sit there and take shots at the greatest Federalist in American history? And if you don't know who I'm talking about, his name is John Adams!
You can't see him in Hamilton.
No, you can't. And I
they
wrote
do call
a whole
him jobless,
John Cena
was.
Rap as John Adams, but I'll spare everyone because this isn't our history of hip-hop. episode.
Absolutely.
I think it is absolutely outrageous that John Adams is crapped all over in this, and I want to.
Well, he has his own musical.
He does. It's 1776. It's a superior piece, in my opinion.
Well,
it has much more John Adams in it.
A lot more John Adams. 100% more.
All right, I got to make my John Cena joke. I'm done.
That's it.
All right.
Should we bring it home?
Yeah.
All right.
So, that's
start warming up to say slash. I'm gonna do an interpretive dance from now until the time I say slash.
Cool. I'll enjoy that. This is our wildcard episode. We'll be back next week with another regular episode. If you found us as you were searching for your fifth, he's really doing an interpretive dance. If you are finding us on a Hamilton thing, stick around. We talk about Shakespeare. You'll learn something. And if you're one of our regulars, and you don't like sports or musicals, we'll be back to the good stuff next week. So until then, you can keep in touch with us by emailing us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at NoHoldsBarredCast, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/ NoHoldsBarredCast. So, on behalf of the Seven Sages Shakespeare Company, my name is Kevin.
And I'm Dan. Go listen to Hamilton and then subscribe to us. And this is in prose. We should probably wrap this, but I can't.
Sir. He can't do it. It's not in his skill set. Adieu, 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 adieu.